Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. We are barreling toward Halloween this week, and our attention is drawn to all things mysterious and sometimes dark. Humans and their behavior can be downright frightening, too, and we'll be talking about such things in the second half of today's show. But now, to start us off, here's a little offering from Ken Lane called Halloween Campfire Stories 2018 AD.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
It's nighttime in the Mojave, and it's our favorite time of year. Time for campfire stories. Well, everybody gathered round. Blankets around the shoulders, maybe some hot chocolate or a hot toddy to warm the hands and the heart. Just you and me and the fire. And red, blue, black, silver cooking up some haunting sounds. And maybe a couple monsters and murderers. The reason for the season.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming out to this Halloween campfire stories. It's a good night for such stories. The plan is we will do these again on the last Wednesday of November and the last Thursday of December and the last Thursday of January. They're on the Ace Hotel calendar, and if I have the dates right, I will mention them on the radio show. There's a Desert Oracle radio show that broadcasts Friday nights at 10 p.m. in Joshua Tree on 107.7 FM KCBZ. And that's really the best way to hear the show. You can hear it driving through Mojave National Preserve, kind of coming in and out as the mountains block the signal, right before they get you, right before the satanic cult pulls you out of your car. Yeah. You can enjoy some quality radio on the FM. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story, and I'm going to quote a witness and part of it, because it's a pretty good quote, but we'll get there in a minute. 1947 was a very, very strange year in America. It was the beginning of the UFO phenomenon around the world. Started with a pilot out west called Kenneth Arnold, who gave them their name, kind of by mistake. He described this fleet of boomerang-shaped craft as skipping across the sky, like if you skipped a stone, or in his weird family, a tea saucer, on a pond. So instead of kind of flying from point to point, like a plane or a bird, it would be in one place, then be in another, and they all sort of skipped across the sky in this way. 1947 was also a crucial year for a occult lodge called the Agape Lodge in Pasadena that was led by the founder of the Jet Propulsion Lab, Jack Parsons, and his roommate and friend, until the friend stole all his money and disappeared, a guy named L. Ron Hubbard. They performed a ritual in the Mojave Desert out by Rocket Site Road, the north end of Edwards Air Force Base, the old Muroc Airfield. Now, for many years, I thought Muroc Airfield, that's the place in the right stuff, you know, with Chuck Yeager and all these aircraft records and test flights and these maniacs. I thought it was a Native American name because it sounds like some of the names you hear in some of the tribes of the Mojave. But proving that you must always keep reading weird things so that you will continue learning strange trivia in middle age, I very recently learned that a family, the Curum family, of Scottish descent, I believe, decided to name their ranch that eventually became Edwards Air Force Base the letters of their last name in reverse. So Muroc is simply their name reversed. Anyway, Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard did a magical ritual. They were running the California Lodge of Aleister Crowley, the famed wickedest man alive, a magician and occultist from England, of his OTO. I believe it means Ordo Templi Orientis. His magic lodge that was started in the Romantic era in England that he took over about a century and 30 years back from now. Parsons and Hubbard were working on something they called the Babylon Working. And the intent was to open a hole in our reality and let something come through. And the symbol of this was going to be the appearance of a redheaded woman who appeared in the form of an artist named Marjorie Cameron. She showed up at the Pasadena Lodge. So they did this weird ritual. And if you've read any Crowleyan rituals, they weren't so much about like sacrificing goats or whatever. And I want to keep this, you know, for a family audience. But basically, it involved a lot of self-pleasure in a ritual context. And chanting and spells and invoking various demons. The weird thing about Crowley is that a entity from another dimension was speaking to him when he was living in Cairo in Egypt in the 1910s, I believe. And he drew this creature and it dictated the Book of the Law to him. And you look at this creature, and it is exactly the gray alien of our modern mythology, of the X-Files and whatnot. He did not claim it came out of a spaceship. So 1947 was a year of constant shocks, kind of like 2018. There were just a lot of things that did not add up with what people expected before. People were processing an enormous amount of evil, of atomic bombs dropped on cities in Japan, of Nazi concentration camps, of UFOs, of the horrible World War almost instantly transforming into a constant anxiety of the Cold War. So when a guy named Howard Hill spoke before the Los Angeles Transportation Club in September 1947 for a lunchtime audience and claimed that he was representing a friend and client who had discovered an underground city of a lost civilization in the Panamint Mountains outside of Death Valley. And it was like number 62 of weird things that year. But it did make the national news, which was kind of the point. And the Associated Press put out a bulletin that these explorers had fallen through the alluvial soils near Wingate Pass on the south end of the Panamint Mountains in Death Valley and had dropped into caverns that they explored for days that went for miles and miles, caverns that were filled with evidence of a lost civilization. It made the rounds in the news, but because the discoverers described the implements of the civilization as being identical as those used in Masonic temples, which were kind of common middle-class social clubs at the time, they were sort of laughed off the world stage and nothing much came of it. But there was a Death Valley writer named Bork Lee, and he wrote several books collecting the lore of Death Valley. And he's got a book called Death Valley Men that first was published in, I believe, 1938. Where he relates a story that was told to him by a couple of miners that he picked up on the two lane north of Furnace Creek who were having car trouble. Bork Lee placed the event in the 1920s, and a Mr. White, who was part of this party of three kind of hardscrabble miners in a broken down car, he took them back to their place and they sat around and had some drinks around the table. And they shared this. Mr. White claimed that they fell through alluvial soils very close to this point by Wingate Pass, south end of the Panamints. And they dropped into what looked like a subterranean built environment. They went from room to room finding weird things. In one chamber they found mummified saber-toothed cats and dire wolves like you see at La Brea tar pits. And then they come into a great vast chamber, a long dining table in the center of it. He says gold spears, gold shields, gold statues, jewelry, thick gold bands on their arms. I found them. I fell into this underground city. There was an enormous room, big as this canyon. 100 men were in it. Some were sitting around a polished table that was inlaid with gold and precious stones. Men stood round the walls of the room carrying shields and spears of solid gold. All the men, more than 100 men, had on leather aprons, the finest kind of leather, soft and full of gold ornaments and jewels. They sat there and they stood there with all that wealth around them, and they are still there. They are all dead. In the next chamber, there were openings in the mountain walls. And crawling up to the edge of these openings, they claimed that there was something smooth, like landings, like boat landings. And looking down, they could see the green of Furnace Creek below on the bottom of Death Valley. Well, they got out of there. They had drawings, maps, and they tried to find someone interested in coming in and sharing their discovery. So they contacted the Smithsonian, and they said, you can have it all for $5 million. Surely a bargain with billions of dollars of gold and ancient treasures. The Smithsonian wasn't interested, but they got a little bit of local interest from the Southwest Museum in Los Angeles, which Gene Autry was a big funder of. But the winter season came in just in time for flash floods to erase all evidence of their entrance. As they said, it changed the country all around, and they could never find it again. The miners are known to tell a lot of tall tales. Death Valley Scotty in Death Valley was one who was famous for it. And he was lucky enough to have a rich benefactor who let him live in the beautiful castle that came to be known as Scotty's Castle, which was a couple of years ago so damaged by flash floods that you could not even get access to it. It is something that happens there. Kenneth Arnold, who spread the idea of the UFO, his story appeared in the first issue of a magazine called Fate. Now, Fate was one of these magazines like Amazing Stories, these pulp magazines, but it was all supposed to be real. It wasn't fiction. It wasn't marketed as fiction. In the seventh issue of Fate, it's a magazine edited by a very strange character named Ray Palmer, there's an article called Secrets of the Hav-Musev. Now, this was an article that purported to tell the story of the Timbisha people, the Timbisha Shoshone, who still live in Death Valley after a long fight with the federal government to get a reservation just outside of Furnace Creek, and then a summertime reservation in the Pinyon Mountains of the Panamints. Of a kind of skyship that they said had been going back and forth across Death Valley between the Panamint and Funeral Mountains for as long as they'd been there, which had been about 1,000 years since they displaced the culture there before them, probably the Fremont culture. And they said that these strange characters were in these skyships. And they described them as having this long golden hair and this tanned skin and these piercing eyes And it's a description that matches almost exactly what George Van Tassel, the builder of the Integratron, gave for his space visitors. Space brothers, whatever they were. They gave him instructions to go broke in Landers. Build a dome with no nails. Many years later, Charles Manson heard these stories. He probably heard them on a television show called Death Valley Days, which was for a while hosted by Ronald Reagan. Of a underground civilization beneath Death Valley, beneath the Panamints especially. And he was intrigued by the story of Devil's Hole. Devil's Hole is a real place. It has the endangered Devil's Hole pupfish. And nobody knows how deep it goes or where it goes. But when there's a heavy earthquake in Alaska or South America, the water sloshes out of Devil's Hole in Death Valley. In 1965, four young divers, some of them still teenagers, went snorkeling into Devil's Hole. Only two of them came back. Afterwards, scuba divers went looking for them and they found no trace. The only thing that was ever found was a scuba mask and a flashlight that had been kind of hung on a rock several hundred feet in as a sort of marker. Charles Manson started telling his followers that there was an underground paradise under Death Valley. Now, once they started the race war in Los Angeles with their murders in the summer of 1969, they would hide out somewhere underneath the Panamints where there were streams of fresh water and magical trees that had different fruits for each month of the year that would give them everlasting life. And the family believed it. So when he took them to the Panamint Mountains to a place called Barker Ranch, which they rented from a hardscrabble cattle rancher on what was then BLM land, it's now part of Death Valley National Park, they would go out on scoping expeditions looking for the hole that would lead to the underground paradise. Up in Saline Valley, he tried to get a couple of his family members to dive into a hot springs and find the bottom, but it was too hot. They tried to find the bottom with a stone tied to a rope. They couldn't find it. And it said that he meditated for 3 days at Devil's Hole, hoping for a revelation that would show him how to get through the waters and to the underground land that he had heard about from TV. Instead, in October of 1969, they were all arrested. Even Manson found hiding under a bathroom sink in the homestead because they had been going around stealing dune buggies and vandalizing national park signs. It turned out that he picked up his philosophy from a weird offshoot of OTO, the Crowleon Lodge, called the Solar Lodge. It started in 1965 in Los Angeles, right across the street from USC. They had a bookstore, an occult bookstore. They wound up going out to a place called Vidal Junction, which is just outside of Blythe, about 2 hours east of here. And they took over the gas station and the cafe and the motel. And they probably could have stayed out there a long time making their plans for the apocalyptic race war that would end our civilization. But there was a six-year-old boy named Saul Gibbons, who was the child of some of the members of the Solar Lodge, even though they were not particularly taking care of him. It was a cult. The kids were sort of free range. Well, he accidentally, it is said, maybe not accidentally, considering what he burned, started a fire in a barn, an outbuilding, that contained all of these precious papers of Aleister Crowley, spell books and diagrams into the other world, curses, letters, correspondence, rules. And the members of the Solar Lodge were furious. And so they began torturing the child. They burnt his hands and fingers with matches. And then they locked him in a shipping container, left him out under the desert sun, a bucket for food, a bucket for water, a bucket for a toilet. When the sheriff's deputies got there, they found the child sitting in there, shackled around his ankles, baffled as to what was going on, the whole place swarming with flies, 110 degrees. And they got him out. And they arrested people. Some people fled on bail. Some people disappeared into Mexico. But there was a trial in October 1969 in Indio. And there were convictions. And during that trial is when National Park Service police, CHP, and Inyo County sheriffs raided the Manson family's Barker Ranch in the Panamints. Manson was not a member of the Solar Lodge, but he had passed through enough to take the absolute worst of what they'd come up with.
And across the great Mojave Wilderness. This has been Desert Oracle Radio with a bonus episode on KCDZ 107.7 FM in the high desert for your Halloween weekend. Be extra careful when you're driving around, lots of little bloodthirsty goblins running around. Plus all those children in their Halloween costumes. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver for the soundscapes, and to you for listening to the program. Yes. Desert Oracle Radio is headed out on tour November-December 2021. Tickets are on sale now at DesertOracle.com. This is Ken Lane signing off. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio at 95.9 FM. Now I have a treat for you. My friend Marlene has a couple local history tales that took place in places you might know.
Hi, my name is Marlene Caulfield, and I am a volunteer at the History Museum in Bozeman. I'm going to tell a couple stories that take place in the late 1800s, early 1900s, about the same time period. The first one, I like to say Montana didn't develop very quickly until gold was found. But around this area, it wasn't gold that they were mining, it was coal. In the area between Bozeman and Livingston, there were between 20 to 30 coal mines and at least three coal mining towns. The one I'm going to talk about is Storrs, which is located right on Trail Creek Road. Trail Creek Road had three sawmills because it took a lot of lumber to develop the towns and the mines. And these mountains were actually clear cut. All the timber you see now is second growth. Well, one of the mines, there were a couple partners, John Reeder and Martin Zidmeyer. The two of them worked well together at the beginning. But in the late 1890s, Martin Zidmeyer's daughter, Bertha, confided in her father that she was pregnant, and it was his partner that got her pregnant. Well, after that, bad blood and frequent arguments occurred between the partners. And things got even worse after the baby was born. We're at the end of the Victorian age, and so having a child out of wedlock, and after the baby was born, they found out it actually had some handicaps, and Mrs. Zidmeyer could not handle the dishonor she felt that it brought to the family, and she committed suicide. Martin Zidmeyer called his partner to the sawmill, and he's yelling at him, "You are the cause of all my problems. If you were just half a man and you married my daughter, none of this would have occurred." Well, John Reeder reminded him, "I've told you over and over again, I'm not the father of your daughter's baby, and so why would I marry her? It's not my fault that your daughter is a floozy." And at that point, Martin is so mad, he pulls out a gun and he shoots his partner dead. Well, what he didn't know at first was two of the sawmill workers actually overheard the argument. And when he realizes that they're witnessing this murder, he calls them over and he has them help him bury the body into the burning sawdust. And then he makes them promise that they would keep it a secret, never to tell anyone. Well, it seemed like things were going better for Martin Zidmeyer. John Reeder, of course, never showed up back at Storrs, and the town is kind of wondering what happened to him. And a few people say, well, you know, he does like to hunt. He probably kind of met an unfortunate accident while he was hunting. And they left it at that. And for a couple years, nothing was said. Until finally, one of the sawmill workers that had overheard and buried the body confides in his wife that he has this terrible secret that he's keeping, and it's just eating him up. This was Andy Wiedenbauer. Well, she convinces him, you need to go to the authorities and tell them. So he does. He goes to the sheriff and he tells them everything, and they pick up Martin Zidmeyer and they put him in jail. And as the trial begins, the public attitude was, well, on the side of Martin Zidmeyer, because after all, his partner did a horrible thing defiling his poor daughter. But at the end of the trial, new evidence surfaced in the form of a letter from Bertha to her lover that she had written 5 years earlier, stating, well, you know, honey, you are the father of this child, but I have a plan that I'm going to accuse my father's partner because I'm hoping we can get his half of the business. Well, at this, Martin Zidmeyer was found guilty, and he was scheduled to hang. Well, while he's waiting for his hanging date, he has visitors coming in and out, and we're not sure if it was a friend or maybe even some of the jailers that were friendly with him. One of them brought him a leather strap, and he kind of hid it away in a little mouse hole that was in the cell. Well, the night before his scheduled hanging, he pulled the strap out and cheated the gallows, in the sense he hung himself. Well, I like to say Montana has a long history with hangings, starting with the vigilantes or even before, and, you know, lots of public hangings, and when jails were built, they had to have their gallows. And so our history museum is located in the old jail, built in 1911, and it does have an inside gallows. And so if you come and take a tour, we'd be happy to show you where our gallows is located. My second story is also during the same time period. John and Alex Black came to Montana to start cattle ranching, and they settled in the area of Salesville. Now, if you don't know, Salesville has been renamed to Gallatin Gateway. John did marry a gal in Virginia City when he first came to Montana, but it didn't work out. She did not like living on a ranch, and so they got divorced. And so for years, he lived as a bachelor rancher. In 1900, Lucy Kirkpatrick comes to town. And she had been married also, but we're not too sure what had happened to her husband. John hires her to be his cook and housekeeper. And about 6 months later, they decide that they will get married. And they do. And they become Mr. and Mrs. Black. 3 months after that, John brings home a good friend of his, Ira DeLong. And Lucy fixes dinner for him. She serves them ham, mashed potatoes, and fresh vegetables right out of their garden. After dinner, the men start to complain of stomach aches, and their stomachs are cramping up, and it gets worse and worse to where they're vomiting even. And it is thought that perhaps the ham wasn't good, maybe it wasn't cured enough, and that they had eaten rotten meat. But the odd thing was, Lucy also had eaten ham, and she didn't get sick. Well, both men, after a day or so, improved and got better. And about 2 months later, again, John brings home his friend, Ira DeLong. And this time, Lucy served them oxtail soup. And again, the men got violently ill, their stomachs cramping, and they're throwing up. It was terrible, worse than the first time. Ira goes home. He has a friend pick him up some essence of peppermint, which does calm his stomach some, and he does recuperate in a day or so. But John continues to vomit, throwing up for days upon days, till finally he begs his wife to take him to the infirmary in Bozeman, which she does. Well, he's there for a couple days, and he starts to feel better, and she tells the doctor, I'm taking my husband back home. I can take care of him. And besides that, we have enough money that if we need you, we'll pay for a house call. So I'm taking him home. Well, as soon as he got home, immediately he took a turn for the worse again. And he's having stomach cramps and throwing up some more. And about a week later, she calls the doctor to come. And when the doctor gets there, he walks in and he can see that John is just delirious, out of his mind. He thinks he's high on morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy, instead of being concerned about her husband, asked the doctor, we would like you to help change my husband's will. Well, at that point, he just gets furious. He turns around, he gets back in his buggy, and he goes over to John's brother, Alex, Alex's ranch. And he tells Alex, I think his new wife is trying to poison him. We need to get him out of there now. So the two men hitch up a wagon and go back to John's house, and they load him up in the back of a wagon. Meanwhile, Lucy is just screaming and yelling, he's my husband. You have no right to take him away. And they go ahead and they take him to, again, the infirmary in Bozeman. Well, by the time the doctor looks at him, he says, I think he's too far gone. I don't think there's anything I can do for him but make him comfortable. And he does die within a day. The doctor calls for an autopsy. And when they do the autopsy, they find morphine, opium, and arsenic all through his body.
Wow.
And the doctor says she must have been poisoning him for weeks.
Wow.
So the sheriff gets involved. They go to the ranch house, and they find a little bag that holds little vials of each of these poisons. And so the sheriff arrests her. So she's on trial. She is found guilty. And interestingly enough, the judge said, because she's a woman, she can't be accused of first-degree murder. Women can't be accused of that. So the strongest thing we can do is accuse her of second-degree manslaughter. And so they do, and that carried 10-year sentence at Deer Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
So she's taken away. She serves 6 of those 10 years, and Lucy gets out on good behavior. What happens to her next? We don't know.
Hmm.
Maybe the Black Widow struck again.
Hmm. Oh. Can our listeners hear more of these stories at the Historical Museum?
There are some more of these stories, yeah. We will be telling dark history stories at the end of this month for Halloween. It is a fundraising event for the museum. We are nonprofit and we run on a shoestring. Lots of volunteers like myself keep it going. So we will be offering dark history tours at the museum October 24th, 25th, 26th, and then the following week, October 31st, Halloween, and November 1st and 2nd. The tours are at 7 and 8 p.m., and it's $15 per person. And to reserve your spot, call 406-522-8122.
Could you repeat that number?
406-522-8122.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, Marlene. Was there anything else that you wanted to say today? Okay. Time to talk about the events coming up. Well, this time, I want to tell you about the Run for Your Life event coming up in Bozeman on October 26th. There's also a virtual run option that you can do anytime between October 20th and October 26th. And to tell you more, this is from their sign-up page. Run for Your Life benefits the Help Center's suicide prevention and crisis intervention in your local community. This is a fundraiser to help a very deep purpose. We aim to bring awareness to suicide prevention, destigmatize seeking mental health help, remember those we have lost to suicide, promote healthy activity, and fundraise for vital Help Center services. This 5K and Kids Fun Run start and end at the MSU Football Stadium in Bozeman. The 5K goes through the South End trails and sidewalks, and the Kids Fun Run goes around the MSU Football Stadium. This event was started in 2015 and continues to grow every year. We were even voted the number one run walk in 2020 and among the top two run walks in 2022. To go to the sign-up page, go to runsignup.com/race/run and then the number 4 and then your life, capital M, capital T, /page-19. Or you can email ryl@bozemanhelpcenter.org. Or if email is not working and your sign up is not working online, you can dial the number 406-587-7511. My thanks to Ken Lane and Red, Blue, Black, Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. And all of our music today has been from Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Thanks to Marlene for her stories from our local past. Thanks to KGVM for supporting this program. And thanks to the underwriters that support KGVM. And thanks to you for listening. I want to hear from you, so call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, stay well and sweet dreams. And Red, Blue, Black, Silver is taking us out. Thank you.
Thank you.